Hello, cinefans. I'm Kendall Kruver, and this is Watching Classic Movies. I love the film suggestions Brian Sauer shares as co-host of the Pure Cinema podcast and as host of Just the Discs podcast and YouTube show. He always comes up with intriguing films I haven't seen from my ever-expanding to-watch list. In this episode, Brian shares five classic film picks and two spares that would be his selections if he were scheduling the TCM Classic Film Festival. I loved the element of surprise in our conversation, especially because some of his picks sound great and I can't wait to watch them. Welcome, Brian. Thank you so much for joining me again on the show.
Pleasure to be back. Thank you for the invite.
We've often talked about how you are a movie fan of diverse interests, and you also love classics as a part of that. So I was very curious to know what you loved, what you found important. And I loved your idea of doing sort of your own programming of the TCM Classic Film Festival, what you would do. And this is something that you do on your Pure Cinema podcast. You make choices with each episode. So I know this is very much kind of in your wheelhouse to make a selection like this. So let's get started. What was your thinking here in this list? And what have you got to share with me today?
Well, I mean, one thing I'll say about the TCM Fest is that even as an LA native, sadly, I don't get to go as much as I'd like. Just the idea that I can't go because of work and things like that. And I always love when everybody comes to town and sometimes get to see people occasionally. But even that's been scarce the last few years because work's been a little crazy. So it's just sort of like an envy kind of thing in part. Yes. It's just the idea of being able to go would be great. But yeah, I see that they do a lot of interesting stuff and they definitely do some less common things. I mean, I definitely keep an eye on what they've programmed here and there because I love to see, especially for sometimes the deep cuts they pull out.
Right.
I'm not sure how many of these have been already programmed. Probably a bunch of them, but maybe not. There's at least one on here I'm pretty sure they haven't done because I think it's a very me kind of movie that I got into the idea of like what's a group of films like a program that would have some variety in terms of genre and would be just classic films that I like that I think are a little underappreciated. I think that was my general approach.
Yes, I love it.
So I can just jump right in if you want.
Go for it. Yes, I'm dying. Okay. I'm dying to hear what you have here.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a sort of a classic screwball comedy, Preston Sturges, Christmas in July from 1940.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, this is one. I don't know. Are you a big fan of this one?
It's not at the top for me. I've only seen it a couple times. But this is Preston Sturges. That's, you know, mild interest with Preston Sturges because this is the kind of thing you revisit over and over again. He's such a talent.
Yeah. And I think I'm with you. Like the first one or two times I'd seen it, I was like, oh, it's a minor film. But the more that I watch it, the more that I kind of love it, you know, and to the point where it's now in my top tier, you know, it's really gone up. Like, I mean, obviously there's, you know, you have your Lady Eve, you have your Sullivan's Travels, Palm Beach Story. Those are the trio I think a lot of people hold really high. But this would be maybe number four for me. Like it's really, really, for people that don't know, it's Dick Powell starring in this movie with Ellen Drew as sort of his sweetheart. And he works, I think, at a coffee company, and he has big ideas for marketing. And there's a contest for a coffee company called Maxford House. And they're having a sweepstakes basically where you can pick a slogan. And his slogan is ridiculous. It's incredibly memorable because it's so ridiculous. It's, if you can't sleep at night, it's not the coffee, it's the bunk, which I've always thought is so silly. But for whatever reason, somebody in his department decides to play a joke on him when he submits his idea, and they fake a telegram from Maxford House saying that he's won, I think it's like 25 grand or something like that. And he gets so excited. He gets up on his desk in the office and makes a big scene, and the boss comes out and is like, what's happening here? And he explains it, and the boss is really excited. So the guys that have played the joke can't really out themselves at that point, or they're going to be in big trouble. So he goes down to Maxford House. He shows them the telegram. And because they don't communicate properly, like they have the head guy and then a group of people led by a really great Bill Demarest, who's like one of the regulars that Sturges would use. the guy in the top is like, oh, I guess they picked a slogan. I guess you do win. And he gives him the check and he goes off and he puts the money against like an account that he uses at a department store and starts buying furniture for his mom and presents for everybody. That's why it's like Christmas in July. But soon enough, the company figures out that he didn't win. And so then they have to sort of like retract and it becomes this whole complicated mess. But it's a really sweet movie, especially by the end. And I just really love Dick Powell in it. And I find it very, very funny and just really charming. And maybe one of the most charming films Sturge has ever made for me, you know, ultimately.
Does it seem, because he does have charm in his films, but they also have quite an edge. Does this one seem like it's a little sweeter? I mean, is that kind of the appeal of it?
I think so. I think that's what, especially not to get too whatever about the last several years, but I've just been looking for sweeter movies. I think ultimately, you know, maybe The Edge I always appreciate, but sweet movies really have been something that I've wanted in higher supply ultimately. So I think that's part of the reason this one's come back to me a lot. So that's, I think, a fun way to start.
And you make a good point that we are, I think a lot of us are looking for something a little kinder and gentler. And I think in you saying that, I need to revisit it because that's something that I've been in search of myself. And, you know, any Preston Sturges is good to me, even though I do have my favorites that I've revisited a lot more, you know?
Yeah, no, he is truly one of my favorites ever. And so it's been fun to have something that I thought was, for me, ultimately minor become a major work. You know, and it may not be the case for everybody. Maybe there'll be a slight film to a lot of people, but I do think it'd be fun with a crowd. That's the other part that appeals.
Yes.
There's that sort of X factor of that. So I'm going to change gears pretty heartily for my second film. I'm going to do something with a war movie, but the connection here is it's directed by Dick Powell and directed pretty well. And it's The Enemy Below from 1957.
I have never seen this. Tell me about it.
Okay, so it is a movie that I discovered because of a small dialogue exchange in Crimson Tide, the Tony Scott movie. I was told, and I'm pretty sure there are some scenes that I can pick out where Quentin Tarantino did some polishes on some dialogue. And there's a specific scene with James Gandolfini and some sailors in a bus. And basically, he's trying to quiz them on movies, and they're so specific that I'm like, this feels like a Quentin line to me. But the line specifically, he's talking to one of the, you know, lower class seamen, and he says, who played the German sub commander in The Enemy Below with Robert Mitchum? Was it Kurt Jurgens or Hardy Krueger? And I'm like, that's a real specific reference.
That is the deepest of cuts.
Exactly. And I didn't know Enemy Below. I didn't know Kurt Jurgens, and I didn't know Hardy Krueger. I didn't know any of those actors at the time, and I've come to appreciate all of them. But Kurt Jurgens plays the German sub commander in this movie, and he's fantastic. So it's a really, really great performance. But the idea is that Mitchum plays a captain of a World War II destroyer, but he's a former a merchant marine, sort of a marine reserve guy. And so his crew is, you could say, underconfident in his abilities as a commander. And so he kind of has to prove himself. And they are able to sort of spot this U-boat, which is, again, headed by Kurt Jurgens. And it becomes a really fantastic naval battle, you know, cat and mouse kind of movie, because they're both very clever in their maneuvers and stuff. You know, it's stuff that I feel like influenced things like Hunt for Red October. Like, if you watch the naval maneuvering that they do, it really feels like something like that could have been an influence on that movie. But Kurt Jurgens is this world-weary Nazi U-boat captain who feels like he's lived too long and he doesn't really see as much joy in waging war with the technology that's available in 1957, where they can track, you know, torpedoes and stuff like he sees it as he's sort of an old gladiator that isn't into the new toys as much. And yeah, he really sets up a great character that you have sympathy for and that you kind of don't want to see killed, but at the same time, he's the bad guy and you get it. So it just really becomes a wonderful tête-à-tête between Mitchum and him. And I just absolutely love it. It's one that I've come back to. I think I discovered it 3 or 4 years ago, and I've come back to it 3 or 4 times since. And just as a side, my love of naval warfare movies was increased significantly by the release of Greyhound, when that Tom Hanks movie. I don't know if you saw that one.
I didn't see it, no.
It's one of those things where I get that naval war movies are kind of a niche that maybe not everybody's into. But that one in particular, it's like 90 minutes long. It's like one of the shortest, most lean naval warfare movies. And it's another one that I feel like could draw some influence from The Enemy Below, because it is a kind of a destroyer captain who's looking for confidence from his crew, and he's doing sort of a lot of maneuvering that's similar to this one. So anyway, I really enjoy it. I think it's a lot of fun. If you like Mitchum and you don't know Kurt Juergens, this will put him on the map for you, I'm pretty sure.
I love Mitchum. Just revisited Out of the Past last night, even.
Oh, very nice.
Kurt Juergens, I have to admit, the only reason I know that name is because he was in a film with Dorothy Dandridge. So you've got me curious about the actor. I do admit I don't know much about naval films. It hasn't been a dislike so much as I just haven't gone there.
I totally get it. It's not necessarily going to appeal to everyone, but there's something about the above below thing, like, and how tricky it is to fight a war like that, to beat a submarine that's beneath you and can easily destroy your ship. It's I've always found it an interesting tension balance.
It's so,
you know, all
these men who are so vulnerable. It's an unusual thing to see. So
it's
true.
It's very true.
Yeah.
Okay. So next up, a Western. This is an Audie Murphy Western, and I've come to appreciate him a lot more in the last 5-6 years too. But this is my favorite one by a good margin. And I don't feel like it doesn't have a Blu-ray. So I feel like it's a little underrepresented right now, but it's called Ride Clear of Diablo. It's from 1954.
Another one I've never heard of. Oh my gosh, this is very exciting, Brian.
Well, it's a blast because it stars Dan Duryea, and I'm guessing you're a Dan Duryea fan, probably. Oh, yeah. He's so good in this. Like, it's truly one of my favorite Dan Duryea roles on top of everything else. But the idea is that Audie Murphy plays, he's kind of like he's kind of like a more naive version of Ricky Nelson's character in Rio Bravo, Colorado. He's like a good gunslinger, but he's a bit naive, whereas Colorado's sort of more streetwise, if you will, in that film. And so it starts out with, you find out that it's Audie Murphy's brother and his dad run a cattle ranch. Their herd is hijacked at the beginning of the film, and they are shot and killed by the hijackers. And he's out of town. I forget if he's an actual lawman or not, but so he comes into town trying to figure out what happened. And you immediately get a sense, I'm not going to spoil too much, but you immediately get a sense that the townsfolk, especially the higher ups, may not have the best intentions. And they immediately send him off on a wild goose chase after, because he's like, who did it? And they're like, oh, well, we don't know. Maybe this guy, Whitey Kincaid, and that's Dan Duryea, who's like one of the most notorious outlaws in the territory. And I think the idea is that he will go after Whitey Kincaid, be immediately killed, and they won't have to deal with him anymore. But the movie has this great scenario where the characters continually underestimate Audie Murphy's character. And so he always kind of finds a way, and he is able to, I think partially because it's so unexpected, Dan Duryea comes in to this bar where, you know, Audie's been working, looking for him. And Duryea's got a great laugh in this. He's just constantly laughing, like the kind of like throw your head back.
Oh, I love him so much.
And he's so great at that. So he comes in and he, you know, underestimates him, and they, you know, he's going to take him. He ends up trying to take him back in. And then it becomes a thing where eventually maybe he befriends the Audie Murphy character, and it becomes a buddy movie, and they're trying to figure out who did this killing. And it's just a blast. And I just think between Audie Murphy and Dan Duryea alone, it's like one of the great buddy Westerns of the 1950s. I just think it's a blast. It's so good.
I just can't believe I haven't even heard of this.
It's one of those that was on like an Audie Murphy. He did so many, though. That's the thing. He did so many Westerns. There's so many that I hadn't heard of. I'm trying to think. They played a couple at the New Beverly this past year that I think are, not to invoke Tarantino again, but I think he's a big fan. And there was Hellbent for Leather and Posse from Hell, two of which I'd never heard of until that screening. And so there's just a ton of his stuff. I know No Name on the Bullet is another one that Joe Dante favors a lot, and that's a great one. But this one, to me, again, for the Duryea factor, I think it really ultimately ends up being the best. The supporting cast includes Susan Cabot, Russell Johnson, Jack Elam, Denver Pyle. So a lot of Western familiar faces, you know, but a good group for sure.
Yeah. But, well, in, an interesting group too, like familiar Western faces, but the most interesting of the familiar Western faces.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what I'm liking about these choices so far is that they're also favorites of people who I consider maybe the professional film fans, the people who have made a life of finding all this amazing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a lot of fun. I know you do it too, and a lot of us big time, especially the classic films, because there's just, it's such a rich, you know, vein of ore for you to dig into, and you never really run out. Like, I just don't think, even as far in as you and I are to our love of classic film, there just continues to be more stuff that we can dig out. And I kind of love that, you know, almost renewable resource factor of it, you know?
And that you can get access, maybe not the most beautiful access sometimes.
True.
You know, you might have to go to devious means, but it's out there. There exactly. are ways to find it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that you can do it.
But it's also been great to see, you know, companies like Kino Lorber and some others, Indicator, digging up a lot of this classic stuff and still putting it out on physical media. And I think giving it a new avenue for people to see it and bringing attention to titles that people weren't aware of. So I love that the labels are at least trying to do some digging for us as well. So that's kind of neat to see, I think.
And I do have to add that you're just the Discs podcast, and you're also on YouTube, does dive into a lot of that stuff as well. So I do recommend that to you all listeners.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's a good show. A good, simple, straightforward show.
And very much.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Just the Discs is really what it is.
Yeah. And sometimes that's all you need. Just keep it simple. And that's just what you want to hear. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Okay. So one for November, I've got a noir to follow next here. This is Pushover from 1954. You a big fan?
I love this. I saw it for the first time on the big screen, and I feel so fortunate that I did.
Did they play this? Oh, okay. Noir City. Okay.
Yeah,
that's
so
great.
It was in Seattle. It was in Seattle.
So not a TCM film festival yet, maybe, but I'm not surprised that it played part of Noir City. I mean, that's, you know, one of those things where they really do a lot of deep cuts and do some interesting choices. This one's directed by Richard Quine from 1954. Fred McMurray and Kim Novak, but I think it's a really neat companion piece to Double Indemnity one decade later, you know, just because it's a similar sort of guy in over his head sort of noir with Fred McMurray.
Yeah.
This time he's a cop instead of an insurance guy, but the idea is that he's part of a team that's trying to track down, I guess, like a known criminal that's on the loose, basically. And she's the girlfriend of that guy. But they initially set it up as like him meeting cute with her in a movie theater parking lot where her car won't start. So he gives her a ride while she gets her car fixed, and they hit it off pretty quickly. And so I'm always suspect of that sort of thing, but they do seem to have a genuine connection. But you find out quickly that he's a cop, and she finds out he's a cop. And she starts to rope him into a scheme to get 200 grand, which I think is the money that the guy on the loose stole. And so she's trying to get him in on that, but he's investigating the case. So he's fully in over his head almost right away. And it becomes this thing that sort of builds up. E.G. Marshall plays one of his lieutenants or something like that. And it has a great tension about it, where it just continues to build towards the end. And you're just more and more worried about Fred McMurray, because I find him a very, you know, sort of affable, downtrodden dude. And I just find him very sympathetic. So, but I'm so jealous you got to see this on the big screen already. This would be such a great big screen movie.
It was really great. And it's funny that you mentioned Double Indemnity, because I left it wishing that I'd seen Double Indemnity for the first time on the big screen too. But I think the big difference there is that Barbara Stanwyck is very much a movie femme fatale, whereas the Kim Novak character in this, you could see a real person being like that. And I like it both ways. I like the larger than life, and I like the, oh, I could just precisely see this happening to some ordinary schmo.
Yeah.
You know, just being stunned by this gorgeous woman who flatters him with her attention. So I like it a little bit because of the comparison I have in my mind between the two films and how that's two sides of noir that I really love.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a wonderful film.
An early role for Novak too. I think maybe not her first, but really early, and she's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's an excellent choice. And I love noir. And I am the only thing that helps me to get over my heartbreak over a spooky season, you know, fading away, is that boom, we're right in noir, you know, in November.
Yeah. No, yeah. It is a great help to me as well. I'm exactly the same as you. Like the end of October is depressing, you know, and the fact that Halloween is the last day of the month. And so you're building up to that last day. And you could immediately be depressed, but then you can just dive into some noir. So that does help a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, Pushover is part of the Columbia Noir number 4 set that Indicator put out. Indicator being the UK label that I love. I talk about them a lot on Just the Dis. And this is one that I discovered through that set. So very cool movie. Okay, this last one of the 5 is the one that it's more of a me movie, you know, so like, I don't know if this is going to appeal to everyone, but I do think it's a lot of fun. And I do think it would be a good one to screen for people in a crowd. It's called Two on a Guillotine and it's from 1965.
I love this movie.
Oh, that's so awesome. I'm so glad you dig this. Yeah this is the one I feel like a lot of people know about because, you know, it's Dean Jones and Connie Stevens. And I grew up with a lot of live action Disney, like our local video store, grocery store had everything that Disney put out on video at the time. And Dean Jones is such a big part of the Disney canon that I will always consider him a Disney guy, but this is not a Disney movie exactly. This is a Warner Brothers. Well, not, it's Warner Archive put out the Blu-ray.
Right.
But the idea is that with him is that I always think of him as Disney. But this movie I think of is, I kind of call it like William Castle meets live action Disney is kind of what I think of it as.
That works for me. Yes.
I like both things. I definitely like William Castle a lot. And I like live action Disney a lot. This is the story. And it's directed by William Conrad, actor William Conrad. And I do think it's a neat connection that he did this film.
He was a great director. I mean, I could never get enough of him on the screen, but it's wonderful that he directed because he did have a knack for it.
He absolutely did. And I think that's definitely one of the things that's underrated about him. There's a movie called Brainstorm that he did I've always wanted to see, and one called My Blood Runs Cold. So there's definitely some of his stuff that I still need to check out. But this one has really grown on me. I'm a Connie Stevens fan. Like, I like her music, and I think she's, again, a very affable actor and perfect in this particular role. The idea is that Cesar Romero plays a great magician called the Great Duquesne. And we sort of open with him. And this is the sort of William Castle side of things. We see him in the midst of an act, and then there's sort of a fade away, and we realize that he's died. And we're now at the funeral for him, and his daughter shows up. But in the previous scene, we've seen that that's Connie Stevens. Connie Stevens also plays her own mother in this, and she's sort of the partner in the opening magic scene. But anyway, the idea is that he's died, but he has made a declaration before his death that he will come back from the dead. And he has this coffin with a window in it and chains around it. And Connie Stevens is his estranged daughter. She hasn't seen him in forever, but she shows up and is immediately put off by the funeral and the whole showiness of it. She thinks it sort of cheapens his memory and is really upset and leaves, basically. And all the reporters sort of descend upon her. And Dean Jones is one of those reporters, but he tries to play it off like he's not. And he ends up stalking her a little bit, and she gives him one of the most severe smackdowns in terms of like him sort of flirting with her. She's just like, yeah, I'm not interested, in this way that's like really direct, that I found pretty harsh, but very believable, and really sets her character up as somebody who's very untrusting and rightfully so, and doesn't want anything to do with whoever this guy is. But they do sort of end up meeting cute when he goes to, she's willed the old house that he lives in, which is very William Castle, and even has like some William Castle type gags in it that I'm not going to spoil. But it's really cool because the actual reading of the will is held at the Hollywood Bowl, and it's the 1965 Hollywood Bowl. So if you're from LA, it's just kind of neat to see the Hollywood Bowl in 1965, and they do have a really big scene all around it. So I love that. But he ends up meeting cute with her at her haunted house, and eventually they get involved, and then it becomes sort of a mystery of like, she has to spend 7 nights in the house as part of winning her inheritance, and he becomes involved in that and sort of figuring out the mystery of what happened to her dad and what happened to her mom. And I just find it a really delightful, you know, low key horror adjacent kind of story that I think they're really charming together again, the two of them. And it's just a fun haunted house movie at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah, I love this. I need to revisit it. I don't think I've seen it since I reviewed the disc, Warner Archive, the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Which was how I discovered it. They're both actors that people underestimate so deeply. They can do anything. I think with Dean Jones doing Company and his version of Being Alive, seeing that, showing all this emotion, all these levels, might have helped his profile. But with her, with Connie Stevens, I don't know if there's anything that ever has. And she gets mocked for that high-pitched voice, but she's really done a lot of amazing things. I mean, like, you're talking about the music, which is amazing. You know, later on, there was the cult appeal of her being in Grease, and Susan Slade. Oh my gosh, just the heights of melodrama. So good. And there was one that she did in my hometown. It's called Scorchy.
It I don't know this.
Goofiest, trashiest. It's so silly, but she's so great in it. She's this lady cop. She has like a dune buggy chase through the streets of Seattle. It's
I gotta see this.
Oh, it's so much fun. And it's one of those four on Internet Movie Database. Come on, please. I had so much fun. Like, if this movie is so bad, why am I so entertained? You know,
exactly.
That kind of a thing. But I love that. All those things, you know, how she does all these things is really great and fun. But this one shows, I think, a little more like how she could be a little more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And she's no dummy in this. She's got the Barbara Crampton vibe of doing
what you
would do. You know what I mean? You know how Barbara Crampton, she always does what you would do.
Exactly.
She's not stupid.
No.
Her characters are never stupid. And I kind of feel like in this movie, that's Connie Stevens.
Yeah.
She does all the right things. And she plays the mood so well.
Yeah. No, I agree. She's really, she's great. And I got to check out more of her stuff, but I do love her music. She's got a great, there's a song of hers that's in Mulholland Drive. That's really, it's like there's an audition scene and it's three women singing and the director character watching the audition when Naomi Watts's character is brought up to meet him. But like the song is just so memorable, even though it's not Naomi Watts singing it. It's just a scene where they sort of first meet each other or see each other. But the song playing in the background has always been really significant to me. And I was just like, what is that song? And I love that David Lynch loves Connie Stevens, obviously.
It's been so long since I've seen that movie. I remember the scene, but I don't remember the song. But I do agree with you about David Lynch, how he will find these pure, beautiful voices and using them in a way that brings you down to the pits of hell.
It's something, yeah.
All that beauty is always waiting there to be corrupted, and he shows you that kind of a thing. And I kind of feel that a little bit about Connie Stevens, how she'll play these kind of innocent characters who know that they can't be innocent in this world. And there's just this interesting balance there, which I wish people took a little more seriously. This woman is no joke.
I agree with everything you just said. Yeah, her persona could have been used a lot better, I think.
Yeah.
But this is a good example of when I think it was used pretty well. You know,
yes.
So hats off to Bill Conrad for using her and Dean Jones together. Really works for me.
I fully intend to watch all of these in the near future, but I think that might be the one I'll revisit first.
That's fun. I have two quick honorable mentions.
Yes,
I know we have a time limit here, but I'm going to just breeze through these.
Tell me, I have to know.
Okay, one more noir that probably has played Noir City. In fact, I'm pretty sure it has. Shakedown from 1950.
I haven't seen that one, but it sounds familiar. I wonder if it did play because I feel like I've heard that.
Yeah, I'm sure it's something that Eddie Muller's a fan of. It's kind of like a proto Nightcrawler almost, you know, the Jake Gyllenhaal movie in a way. But it has Howard Duff, which is very unexpected for this kind of movie. Like, I've never been a huge Howard Duff guy. I love that he and Ida Lupino were a team, and I think they're a great team. But I've always found him, if I'm being completely honest, a little bland in the roles that he was often given. But this is one of the most almost sociopathic roles he ever had, because he plays a sort of unscrupulous photographer who's trying to get himself on staff at a local big newspaper. I think it's New York. I can't remember where it's set. But we immediately in the beginning kind of get a sense of him and what he's willing to do to get a photo when, like, he's photographing an apartment house fire, and there's a woman at the window that's, you know, get almost going to have to jump out. And he's just like, oh, can you wait just a second? Let me get a picture. Like telling her to stop before so he can get a better shot. You're like, I don't know about this guy, you know? And he knows some woman at the paper who gets him in with the editor at the paper, but the editor is immediately dubious of him as well. He's just like, I don't know about this guy. And it starts to turn into this thing where they put him on some fluffy assignments. And then there's a case with a heavy duty criminal played by Brian Donlevy, who has never had a good photograph taken because he is always ducking photographers. And this guy has a pitch to him, which is like, look, I'm going to take a picture of you either way, but it's going to look better for you if you pose for it, as opposed to trying to duck away from it. And it works. And this guy, Dunleavy, goes for it. And he actually starts to become involved with Dunleavy and get into some criminal underworld stuff. And it goes kind of from there. But it's a really fascinating movie and a great noir. It has a really killer ending that I'm not going to talk about at all. But definitely one that I hadn't seen until, again, Kino Lorber put it out on a Blu-ray. And I was like, oh, what is this? And it's really stuck with me. Really, really enjoyable noir. Shakedown.
I can see the correlation with not only the plot of Nightcrawler, but the extremely manipulative, like down and dirty manipulative nature of the main character. Yeah.
It's very much like that. It's very much like that. And the last thing I'll say is, just because this is one I literally watched last night, it was Halloween night, and I just gotten the Blu-ray for The Devil Doll from 1936. This is a new Blu-ray from Warner Archive. Again, going to praise them a lot on this show because they do a lot of great stuff. But it's Todd Browning, and Todd Browning's having a killer year on Blu-ray because we got The Freaks, finally Freaks getting the Blu-ray with The Unknown and The Mystic. And then Mark of the Vampire got a Blu-ray from Warner Archive this year. So he got like five movies that I think were harder to see getting Blu-rays this year. But this one really stood out for me. It's I guess I had seen it because I had logged it like 10 years ago, but I did not remember it at all. It's Lionel Barrymore and Marina Sullivan kind of as the two main characters. But Barrymore plays a guy who gets out of a prison. I guess it's in France. It's Europe based, with this other dude who's like kind of a mad scientist. And the mad scientist takes him back to his home where his wife slash partner is working on an experiment where they shrink down animals. And his theory is that it's going to solve the hunger population crisis, because we can, where like we'll shrink everybody down and they can exist on less food and stuff like that. And it becomes a thing where Lionel Barrymore wants to use this tech to get revenge on the three guys that threw him in prison for some kind of bank fraud that he didn't commit. And it becomes this whole sort of thing where he's kind of going after them with miniature people and stuff. It's crazy. I can't really even explain it that well, but it's really got some cool effects in terms of the matte shots of little, you know, small people and animals. And it's just got a great vibe to it, a great horror movie vibe that I totally dug. So The Devil Doll would be my other honorable mention, I think.
It's such an eccentric film.
Yeah.
A lot of times people will look at old special effects and say, well, it's not super believable. I'm like, yeah, but is it fun? And those special effects are the most fun. Those little tiny creatures. I love it.
Yeah. And when they build like giant sets around them, and you have to kind of look carefully and go, is this a matte shot or did they build a giant? I think they built a giant set for this. This looks like a giant set. That stuff has always been. I just rewatched The Incredible Shrinking Man. And that's the same kind of stuff where you're just like, wow, they really committed to building these sets and making it feel real and scary because people are small. And anyway, that's what I got. I know we're running out of time, but just some fun classic films for me that I'd love to see on the big screen.
Well, this has been so much fun. And I love that there are things that I had just never even heard of in the list, in addition to some things that I would love to revisit, especially all the noirs.
Yeah.
As the month goes along. Yeah.
Thank you so much for letting me do this. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. It's so interesting to not have to do the prep for the podcast. You were doing everything. It was all a surprise. It was like being given a present or something. So I really appreciate that. Of course, you're so good at making choices and speaking about them like you do on your podcast, Pure Cinema Podcast, which is the official podcast of New Beverly Cinema. So, well, Brian, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And it was so much fun to talk to you again.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
For more information, including where to find more great film picks from Brian via Pure Cinema Podcast and Just the Discs, go to watchingclassicmovies.com. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review wherever you listen. It helps a lot. Thank you for listening. This is Kendall Kruver, watching classic movies. Until next time.